You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we'll talk about the significance of the HBO series Game of Thrones as the final season begins this weekend. First, it's time for our weekly review of news stories from around the state. The race for village president in McFarland came down to a dramatic and unexpected finish this week. Governor Evers put a painting back up in the governor's mansion after his predecessor had it taken down, and UW-Stevens Point is saying that it's choosing not to cut some major programs that had been on the chopping block. Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you.
So, Rob, we hear a lot during election season about how every vote counts, but that was really the case in the election last week for McFarland's village president. The race was close and got even closer. What happened?
Every vote does count. So there are about 8,000 people in the village of McFarland in Dane County, and they elected their village president. The race last week came down to one vote. The incumbent village president got 1,187 votes, and the challenger came up short with 1,186. So it was a close election, but like what else is new, right? The challenger requested a recount. The results held up. That's that. But wait! This week, a staff member at the McFarland Village Hall discovered an unopened absentee ballot. It was in a bin used to store and transfer absentee ballots, which to me, I feel like is probably where you would expect it to be. don't listen to me. I somehow lost the key to my front door not long ago. So this vote, this would have done it. This would have thrown the entire result of the election into chaos. You have a tie. You have to do that thing where they draw straws or whatever. So they opened the envelope, they read the ballot, and lo and behold, it was a vote for the incumbent. Turns out the guy won by two votes, so chaos averted.
Brad Zibatier got a bigger margin because that was found instead of McFarland being divided right up the middle.
Yep, it's a landslide.
Wow, that is a super interesting story. And especially, it is kind of surprising that ballot was just kind of floating around for a while.
Yeah, you hear about these things, right? And I guess one thing that was unusual was that it did happen like a week after the election. But clerks have a hard job. It's a lot of paper to wrangle and so on. But it's probably best that they found it, you know, better to count every vote.
But if anybody thinks their vote doesn't count, this is proof it does. Mm-hmm. Well, Governor Evers held a press event at the governor's mansion recently to talk about something we don't always hear about in state politics, a painting. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm not an art critic, Judith, but I do have excellent taste. This is a good painting. It's called Wishes in the Wind. It is a hyper-realistic painting by the artist David Lenz. So it, like, looks like a photograph, but it has this vividness to it, and it shows a multiracial group of three kids on a snowy Milwaukee neighborhood street, and they're blowing bubbles with these bubble wands. It's really nice. It's really nice. So the painting had been in the governor's mansion, and Governor Scott Walker took it down when he came into office 8 years ago, and he replaced it with a painting of Old Abe, the Civil War era bald eagle. And so this was news that Evers made the decision to restore this painting to its spot in the governor's mansion.
And did Evers say anything? I mean, it sounds like there was kind of an event around it. What did he have to say about making that choice?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this doesn't affect anyone's actual life. This isn't policy. But I think politicians know that there is symbolism or theater or something that is part of their job, and they make choices of what symbols they display, and it does matter. So to Evers, who he has a background in education, it's significant to him. He said as much, that this is a portrait of children, that they're in an urban environment is significant, that the particular subjects of this specific painting have their own backstories as well. One was featured in a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel column on homelessness once upon a time. One had family members killed by a drunk driver. So for sure, for Evers, this is a way of expressing empathy with this sort of neighborhood street, I think.
Did anyone ask former Governor Walker what he thought of the change?
I don't know if anyone asked, but Governor Walker, who tweets a lot these days, had a, you know, he did speak up. He said, like, an alternate headline on this story would be that Governor Evers has removed this portrait of the Civil War. His reason, he has his own symbols, right? He has his own reasons, and he said his were to honor the Wisconsinites who fought in the Civil War and those who lost their lives in the Civil War, which is a good symbol too. So yeah, I don't, you know, I suppose you can get a little wrapped around the axle about the symbolism here, but yes, Governor Walker did have a rather defensive response, I think.
We're talking with Rob Menser right now. He's a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau, taking our weekly look at some news stories from around the state. And Rob, yesterday on the show, we heard about UW-Stevens Point choosing to back off of its plan to cut majors in the liberal arts. We've talked with you about this story pretty often in the past year when it's been unfolding. What stuck out to you about the news that we got this week?
Right. So, yeah, so listeners may know the sort of basic outline here, but it is 1 year ago, UWSP proposed just sweeping cuts, more than 20 majors, history, art, political science, a lot of humanities programs. That then was met with widespread protests in Stevens Point and sort of across higher education circles. The university later came back with a much scaled down plan that still cut some majors, like some languages, but it left most of the other programs intact. And the new news this week is that they won't cut any of those programs after all.
And is this going to stay? I mean, this got national attention. Do you think this role of the humanities in public universities is going to stay in the focus right now?
This is one reason why we've been talking about this story for the last year, right? I mean, it is an important story for Central Wisconsin and for UWSP. But another reason is because this proposal was sort of the most dramatic or sort of the leading edge of a set of other changes that a lot of different regional college campuses are making. The other thing, I mean, I think it's important to understand, like, this, I think it would be a mistake to view this as sort of like total victory for opponents to humanities cuts, because the reason, UWSP is upfront about this, the reason that the programs can be spared is because there's been a wave of faculty retirements, resignations, and essentially what's happened is that they've ended up saving enough money in payroll expenses that they don't need to cut the programs.
So, Rob, probably our most important news of the week. We have some news about you. You've been our weekly guest for the Wisconsin News Roundup since August of 2015. This is our last week with you for this segment, but the news is not all bad. What's happening?
I am really excited. I will, in a couple of weeks here, a week and a half, I will be joining Wisconsin Public Radio as a reporter. I'll be based here in Wausau and able to report on lots of different stories for the state network, I hope.
And your title is Rural Communities Reporter, based in Wausau. What kind of stories are you looking to cover?
Yeah, Rural Communities Reporter. So my way of thinking about this is, you know, everybody knows sort of the big story about rural Wisconsin, right? There, the big story is that rural areas are losing population. The population they have is aging, and there are all sorts of follow-on effects from this, sort of economic and cultural effects. But the way I think about it is that is not all there is to know. There are small cities and small towns in Wisconsin that are doing really interesting things to get young people to move there or to, you know, adapt to changes in their communities. There are interesting stories about entrepreneurs and startup businesses and just fascinating things going on in these communities. And there are also places where the population is not declining at all. One reason is because there are immigrant communities that are growing. Mm-hmm. So there's like a whole bunch of stories. This is the idea. I hope I can tell some good ones, and I'm really excited to try to tackle some.
Well, Rob, we are thrilled to be welcoming you to WPR, and I'm sure we will talk to you in that role.
If I write a good story.
Rob, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Rob Menser is going to be joining WPR later this month as the Rural Communities Reporter. He's been a regular guest on the weekly news roundup since August of 2015. The hit HBO series Game of Thrones begins its eighth and final season this Sunday night. Joanna Robinson writes about the show for Vanity Fair and thinks Game of Thrones has worked its way into the pop culture mainstream in a way we're not likely to see again. Here she joins WPR's Chris Molina to explain, chat about the show's success, and the challenge of ending the show in a way that satisfies viewers.
Joanna, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, what is your excitement level for the Game of Thrones premiere this weekend?
Oh gosh, it's probably a 9. Let's like save one number just in case, but mostly at a 9.
So the last time I remember people being this excited for a television event was probably in 2013 when there were the final few episodes of Breaking Bad. Now, Game of Thrones fans know why they're excited about this show on Sunday. Others might be wondering, well, what's the big deal? Can you explain why there's so much excitement for this?
Yeah, I would say not only for the people who've been watching the show for the better part of the last decade are excited to see how it all ends. You know, it's 6 final episodes. Some of them are movie length and promise to be epic and amazing and all of that. But there's also, you have to consider the book readers who have been reading this book series that George R. R. Martin started in 1991, I think it was, early 90s. So decades they've been wondering how this story ends. And they're finally going to get the answer to that. It might be, you know, on screen, maybe they prefer to have it on the page, but they'll finally have the answers. And so they're really excited for that.
But there's no way, though, that there's going to be one ending that makes everybody happy, though, right? I mean, you've got book readers who have been with the series for a long time. You've got TV viewers who have come to it maybe more recently. We've all got our theories. Is there any way that the show can stick the landing?
I think the stick the landing question is really interesting because that definition differs for so many people, you know? And so I've talked to a lot of the people who work on the show, and they've all said, we're aware that people are worried about the finale. We're aware that we're so big that there's no way people aren't going to look at this and think they didn't quite satisfy all my needs. But I think what I really admire about the people who work on this show is they've said they're not going to let that stop them from swinging for the fences. And so from what I understand, the final season of Game of Thrones is not being made with the fear that people won't like it. It's being made with the idea that the show started with, which is they're going to surprise you. They're going to shock you. They're going to maybe upset you in some ways. And I'm kind of excited for that. I'm excited for the ending to anger some people because then we're going to have this big conversation about it. That's going to be really fun.
So I want to figure out how we got here in the first place. I mean, at its core, Game of Thrones is a fantasy show. We've got dragons. You've got direwolves. You've got essentially ice zombies. So in the past, these are not the elements of your typical television show that has mass appeal, and yet this is a show that is in the pop culture mainstream now. What happened?
Yeah, I think what you have to remember, this is something that executive producer of the show, Brian Cogman, told me, and I really loved it. He says, if you look at the first episode of Game of Thrones, it's just about one guy going to his friend's house for dinner and their family's meeting. Like, that's how he thinks of the first episode of Game of Thrones.
You as good with a spear as you used to be?
No, but I'm still better than you.
You know, and it's just sort of like old war buddies. And so if you look at the character of this show, like the zombies, the dragons, the magic, the resurrection, all of that gets sort of seeded in later. And it starts with character and it starts with real relatable stories. And so I think a lot of people were put off at first or just unsure that the show is for them. I remember a really scathing New York Times review, you know, dismissing the show as sort of silly fantasy or something like that. But over time, especially with the various twists and turns that George R. R. Martin had written into his story early on, the reaction, the emotional reaction it incited in viewers was hard to ignore. So when you have something like season 3, The Red Wedding happens, even if you don't watch Game of Thrones, you've maybe heard the phrase Red Wedding. When that happens, and all these reaction videos, these genuine reaction videos go viral.
No, 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 no!
Oh, no! Oh, oh, really?
You guys knew about this?
then people start to perk up and pay attention, and they're like, what is this show that is causing people to scream and cry in their living rooms? And maybe I want to watch it too. And so you just see the audience build over time as people realize that though the dragons and the ice zombies and all of that is part of the show, it's not the core of the show.
Is it kind of amazing that this model that Game of Thrones is using, this idea that you're still waiting for one episode a week versus what's happening elsewhere in pop culture where content producers are eager just to drop seasons in your lap? Is it kind of amazing that this model still exists and that we're still just going crazy for it week after week?
Yeah, and I actually wish people who use the binge model, which is almost all digital streamers now, your Amazons, your Netflixes, et cetera, would pay attention to what, how much power a show has when we get to watch it week by week and spend weeks at least talking about one story altogether versus, you know, even the most popular show on Netflix, you know, people watch it at different times. You'll binge watch it in a day. Your friend binge watched it a week later. So you're sort of out of sync. You can't talk about it week by week versus Monday morning, you go into work and you go to, oh my God, Game of Thrones last night. That was amazing. And that's what's sad about the end of Game of Thrones, you know, more than even that story going away is that moment going away in our culture, because the binge model is so popular now and the TV landscape is so crowded now. Everyone's attention is so split and fractured that there's no, you know, one show we're all watching together week by week, having these slightly slower conversations about it. And I don't think there's going to be anything to replace Game of Thrones in that arena when it goes away.
Right. I mean, it's hard to remember it now. Back in the dark ages of 2011, I mean, TV streaming was just kind of coming into its own. We were right in the middle of like Mad Men and Breaking Bad. There were a lot fewer prestige television shows to come up with. And, you know, in the future, we're not going to be without Game of Thrones. There's going to be some form of Game of Thrones in our lives. There is at least one prequel in the works that's going to start filming this summer. There's talk of anywhere from like 1 to 4 more of them. But I'm wondering if, because of this changed model, if any of these shows are going to be able to catch that lightning in a bottle twice, or if the model is just permanently changed at this point.
I think it's permanently changed. I mean, I wish the prequels well, and I think they will do well if there are more than one. I think that one will do well. It sounds great. Great creative team, great cast. I'm really excited to see it. I don't think it has any chance of touching like the popularity or the cultural power of the original Game of Thrones. And that's not a knock on it. It's just the fact, even the pure fact that HBO was recently acquired by AT&T, and those new owners have said they're going to increase the content on HBO by 50% by the end of the year. And so we're used to HBO having its few shows on Sunday nights, and that sort of means something. An HBO show means hand-selected, value, elite, sort of prestige kind of thing. And now they're just going to flood the gates to try to keep up with Apple and Amazon and Netflix. And that means the power of what an HBO show is itself goes away. And so I think that not only are the prequel series, however many there may be, will not be able to match Game of Thrones, but all these other networks that are trying to do big, splashy fantasy adaptations, like Amazon's got Lord of the Rings, they've got Wheel of Time, HBO's doing His Dark Materials, someone's doing In the Name of the Wind. Like, they're chasing exactly what Game of Thrones was, but I think as we saw when Lost went off the air, all these other shows tried to be Lost, exactly Lost. And the next Lost wasn't exactly like Lost. The next Lost was like Game of Thrones. You know, so you can't just copy paste what we had before. The culture changes. You need something different this time.
So let's talk about the final episode now. And, you know, we kind of talked about the pressure to really stick the landing. And I think we hear this all the time with shows, that a show can be absolutely great, but everyone's always going to remember that last episode. Like, Seinfeld was a great show. The finale sucked. So in your world, in your view, what needs to happen in this finale to make it not suck?
Like I said before, I think it needs to try to be as true to the spirit in which the show started, which is no cozy happy ending, that some shows think that they have to give you, put a bow and a happy ending on something. And I don't think Game of Thrones wants to or needs to do that. I want it to give us something that feels morally murky and complex. I want us to be arguing over who was right.
You wish to know where my true loyalties lie? Not with any king or queen, but with the people. The people who suffer under despots and prosper under just rule. The people whose hearts you aim to win.
Swear this to me, Varys. If you ever think I'm failing the people, you won't conspire behind my back. You'll look me in the eye as you have done today, and you'll tell me how I'm failing them.
I swear it, my queen.
And I swear this. If you ever betray me, I'll burn you alive.
I would expect nothing less from the Mother of Dragons.
And so that's what I want. There's an easy way to end this, right? Which is Jon and Daenerys by matching Iron Thrones. they sit side by side in King's Landing and raise a bunch of kids and direwolf puppies and dragon babies and, you know, whatever it is. Like, that's the ending I do not want. That ending, in my opinion, sucks. But, you know, give me something weird and dark and that leaves you feeling kind of like, oh, huh. That's how I want Game of Thrones to end.
So in a way, it almost doesn't matter who gets to sit on the Iron Throne at the end, but what does matter is the fact that we get to fight online about it for like the next 6 months.
Yes. Yes. More fighting. Yes.
Well, Joanna, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was fun.
Joanna Robinson is a writer for Vanity Fair, and she joined WPR's Chris Molina to talk about the final season of Game of Thrones. Figuring out the right way to talk about climate change can be tricky. It's a complicated topic, and for a person of faith, a belief in climate change is often painted as being incompatible with religion. But our next guest says the two don't have to be opposed, and she says we can all do a better job of talking about the issue with friends and family. Catherine Hayhoe is a climate scientist and director of Texas Tech University's Climate Science Center. She recently paid a visit to UW-Eau Claire and UW-Madison. Catherine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You were in Wisconsin this week talking about religion and climate change. How does your personal faith fit in with your belief in climate change and your efforts to combat it?
Well, often when I'm asked, do you believe in climate change? That's one of my favorite questions, because my answer to that is actually no. As a scientist, I look at the data, and the data is very clear that climate is changing and humans are responsible and the impacts are serious. But then the question is, what do we do about this? How do we respond to the facts and the information that science gives us? That's where our values come in. And for the vast majority of us here in the US as well as around the world, our values are often informed by our faith.
Why do you think that there is this narrative, especially here in the United States, that you can't be a person of faith and be a believer in climate change or know that climate change is a thing?
Mm-hmm. It's because many people have a vested interest in maintaining what's called the conflict model between science and faith. Now, this conflict model goes back a long time. It is fed by issues of origin and the age of the universe, people like Richard Dawkins on one side and Answers in Genesis on the other. And that's what we talked about this week at Upper House. But there's people who have a vested interest in convincing people that climate change is a religion, that you have to choose between your faith and the science. Because if people already have a belief or a faith that they are very happy with and that is a big part of their identity, as it is mine, then we don't want to believe in a new or a false religion. And so if they can paint climate change as a religion or a belief system, then anybody who already has a religion or a belief system that they don't want to change is going to reject climate change. And that's really what a lot of people want us to do, because people don't want us to fix it. And when I say people, I predominantly mean those who have the balance of power and wealth in this world, which depends on us continuing to burn fossil fuels as our primary source of energy.
You wrote a book, Catherine, about this with your husband called A Climate for Change, Global Warming Facts for Faith-Based Decisions. Why was it important to have something geared specifically to the faith community?
Well, I would have preferred to be able to just find a resource I could give to people. But when I looked, I couldn't find anything that started where the people that I was having the conversations with were at. A book or a resource that got into, well, how do we really know that it isn't a natural cycle this time? Because we know it's been natural cycles before. How do we know that if God is in control, humans could change something as big as our planet? Even questions like, if people believe the world is going to end anyways, why should we worry about what's happening today? We couldn't find a resource that really tackled all of these very common questions that we were hearing all the time. So that is why we wrote our book together. And that's also why I host a PBS series on YouTube called Global Weirding. It's about 35 super short videos so far. We're currently in season 3. And each of these short global weirding videos tackles a common question that we get. And I'll tell you, the fascinating thing is these videos look at science questions, look at impact questions. It explains what's the big deal with 2 degrees and is it too late to fix climate change? But the episode that has the most views of any of our episodes is the one called "The Bible Doesn't Talk About Climate Change, Does It?"
And Catherine, it seems to me that there are actually some of the effects of climate change that we are seeing now or we'll see in the future that are really so closely related to the values of many people of faith. Do you actually see this as an opportunity?
Yes, I completely agree with you, because the reason why I care is because climate change disproportionately affects people who are poor and vulnerable, people who are already suffering today from hunger, poverty, disease, lack of access to clean water, even political instability and refugee crises. And these are the very people that we as Christians are told to care for, the poor, the orphans, the widowed, the people who don't have the resources that we do. So to me, there's a direct connection between my faith, my values, and why I care about the impacts of a changing climate that science describes to us in so much detail.
Catherine Hayhoe is a climate scientist and director of Texas Tech University's Climate Science Center. She recently paid a visit to UW-Eau Claire and UW-Madison and spoke about the intersection of being a person of faith and someone committed to combating climate change. And as we said, there is this concept or this understanding among some people that you can't be both. You can't be a person of faith. You can't be someone who is active in saying climate change exists. It's something we need to address. You are in both circles all the time. Catherine, what have you found personally effective in talking to both of those groups who, let's say, don't often overlap?
Well, we think they don't often overlap. But what is fascinating is that when Elaine Eklund is a sociologist who surveyed 1,700 scientists at top research universities around the U.S. to actually explore this question, because she thought, we always say, oh, those scientists are all atheists, but is that true? She found that 50% of scientists at top research universities in the U.S. identify with a very specific religious label. They would say, I am Christian, or I am Hindu, or I am Muslim. And then 70% of scientists would identify themselves as spiritual people, believing that there is more to our existence and more to life than simply what we can see and observe with our scientific tools. So that really breaks some stereotypes about who and what scientists are. And that, I think, is part of the key to the discussion, because we so often see science and faith as completely different things, which they are very different, but which have nothing to do with each other. And with the issue I study, climate change, it is such a difficult, thorny, challenging issue that we need all the science we can get to explain why it's happening, what impact it's having on us and our planet, and what are the outcomes of the choices that we can make. But then we desperately need our values, which again, for many of us, are informed by our faith, to say, how can we fix this?
And you felt so strongly about the issue of climate change that you really, in some ways, changed the focus of your career to address it. That's a big decision to make.
Yes, I was planning to be an astrophysicist. I love the idea that using nothing more than our brains and the scientific instruments that we can build on this relatively insignificant planet, that we can study the other side of the universe. We can look back in time at galaxy formation and supernova explosions. And so I was planning to pursue astrophysics as a career when I needed an extra course to finish my undergraduate degree. And I looked around and I saw this interesting course in climate science. And I thought, well, that, you know, I know climate change is real. I don't know much else about it. So, you know, might as well take this course. And that was when I was completely shocked to learn that climate change was not only an environmental issue like air pollution or deforestation, but it was a threat multiplier. It is a humanitarian issue. It is an economic issue. It's a human issue. It affects almost every aspect of our life on this planet. And so I thought to myself, well, With the abilities that I have, how can I not study this profoundly challenging issue? Because, as I said, it is disproportionately affecting the poorest and most vulnerable people on the planet who do not have a voice in many cases to stand up and say, we can't survive if this continues.
So you are a Christian who is a scientist. You are a scientist who is a Christian. Which mm-hmm. of those circles have you felt maybe a harder time being your whole self in? Is it in being among other people of faith who might not see that climate change activism and science is compatible with Christianity, or is it on that other side?
Mm-hmm. Well, when I first wrote the book with my husband, who is a pastor, I had bought into the stereotype that many of us have, that scientists are predominantly atheist. And so I thought that the biggest pushback was going to come from my colleagues, to the point where I was actually seriously concerned that I might be flushing my career down the toilet by publishing a book saying that I was a Christian and that climate change was real. But I have to say, I was completely humbled to realize that it is exactly the opposite. I've received so much support and encouragement from my colleagues across the scientific community, from some who share my faith, from others who do not, but who all recognize that to fix climate change, we need everybody on board. In contrast, I am very sorry to say that I have received enormous amount of pushback from the Christian community, from people who say, oh, you can't be a real Christian, to people who say, oh, you're the whore of Babylon, to people who say, you're spreading Satan's lies. And I would say, in terms of collecting all of the negative feedback that I get, and I probably get two or three or four people a day at this point, so we've had, you know, a few years of negative feedback, I would say it's about 999 to 1 in terms of negative feedback from people in the Christian community versus in the scientific community, which is absolutely terrible. I mean, it just breaks my heart.
Catherine Hayhoe is a climate scientist and director of Texas Tech University's Climate Science Center. We're talking with her about the intersection of faith and climate change and the issue more broadly as well. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you talk about climate change with family and friends? Or do you avoid the topic because it seems too political? If you're a person of faith, how does your faith influence your thoughts on climate change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation here on Central Time after this short break. Stay with us. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about faith and climate change. Catherine Hayhoe is with us, climate scientist and director of Texas Tech University's Climate Science Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What have your experiences been like talking about climate change with people in your life? If you talk about it regularly, have you hit any stumbling blocks? And if you don't, what are some of the things that hold you back? What questions you have for Catherine on how to make the issue a bigger part of your everyday conversations? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at CentralTimeWPR. And Catherine, so you said that you have gotten a lot more pushback from people in the faith community than you have from people in the scientific community. So how do you have conversations with fellow people of faith about this issue?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because what I've discovered is that, first of all, if there really is zero mutual respect, then it's really impossible to have a constructive conversation. But if we are able to connect with people over something that we do agree on, a value that we share, an interest that we have in common, a faith that we're both part of, something as simple as the fact that we're both parents, or we're really into planting, you know, plants in our backyards for butterflies, or we enjoy birding or ice fishing, or we go to a similar church. If we are able to connect, first of all, on what we agree on rather than what we disagree, because so often we tend to begin the conversation about climate change about what we disagree on, start with something we agree on, connect the dots to, if we're both this type of person, then we already care about climate change. We might not know it. And then talk about solutions that are consistent and compatible with people's values. And I have a TED Talk that just came out in December that's called The Most Important Thing You Can Do About Climate Change is Talk About It. And I go through and I give a couple of different examples of different ways that we can connect with people and start some positive, constructive conversations that actually end in a better place rather than a worse one.
And we'll make sure that a link to that TED Talk is up at WPR.org/Central Time so people can see that. Let's go to the phones, and John in Mount Horeb is up. Hi, John.
Hey there. It's a really interesting conversation. It's very pertinent to our times, that's for sure. I'm just a recently became a dad. I have a 1.5-year-old boy at home, and that's kind of brought all this stuff amplified into my daily thoughts. But I find it very daunting that a lot of people that, you know, they live a religious lifestyle, or they preach and they, you know, practice all that they you know, learn in church and whatnot, that they would think that this is all a hoax. But it's, you know, if God does exist and he made this planet, then you would think that they would want to try to keep it as pristine as possible and try to protect it. It's just kind of, it's such a contradictory idea. And it just blows my mind every time I hear people that are very, very religious thinking that the idea of global warming and climate change is a hoax.
Thank you for that, John.
Yeah.
And that's a really interesting point, Catherine. Is that something that you've actually used in talking with people?
Yes. Well, John, I completely agree with you. And sometimes I just feel like saying to people, have you not even read the Bible? But that's actually part of the clue. Because sadly today, for many people, their statement of faith, so to speak, is written first by their political ideology and only a distant second by the Bible. So when I speak to people who are fellow Christians, I sort of see what I do as more like holding up a mirror and trying to remind them of who they really are. If you really say that you take the Bible seriously, well, this is what the Bible says. It says God gave humans responsibility over every living thing on this planet. And it talks about the fact that we are to care for others, especially people who do not have the resources we do, who are suffering and today are disproportionately affected by a changing climate. So John is absolutely right. People are not actually living up what they say they believe in. And that is actually a great conversation that we can have.
Thanks for that call. Let's go back to the phones. And Nate in Wanakee is up. Hi, Nate.
Yeah, thanks. Great program. Wonderful.
Thank you.
I want to ask a couple questions, but in light of what you just said, I think one of the points that the faith community is not perceiving is that they're in danger of undermining their credibility to the point that they are becoming idolatrous, in that they adhere more to a political value than they do to the concept of an almighty God. Now, here's my questions. I think you've answered one.
Go ahead.
But I wondered mm-hmm. if you would indicate what the primary pushbacks are that you get from the religious community.
All right. And Catherine, when you get that pushback, what are they focusing on?
Well, first of all, I agree with what you said. And second of all, I appreciate the question because I want to point out something really important that I've learned. When I talk with people, when all of us talk with people about climate change, we often hear either sciencey sounding objections or religiously sounding objections. Now, I don't say scientific or religious. I say science-y sounding or religious-y sounding, because when you actually start to dig into the science or what we actually believe as Christians, we find out these arguments have no legs. So examples are, it's just a natural cycle. If God is in control, how could humans affect something as big as this planet? It's just a tiny bit of carbon dioxide. How could it affect something as large as our planet? Or the world's going to end anyways, or the Bible said there will always be seasons. So our Global Weirding episode on YouTube called What Does the Bible Say About Climate Change? It actually talks about a lot of these religious-y sounding objections. But what I've found having these conversations is that within 30 to 60 seconds, sometimes even in the same sentence, people will immediately pivot 90 degrees to their real objection, which has nothing to do with science and nothing to do with theology. It has everything to do with politics, ideology, and solutions. It will ruin the economy, they say. It would require a big government to fix it. It will let China take over what the US is doing. The objections are all solution-based. We don't believe there is any way that we can fix this thing without ruining the economy, let China rule the world, and pulling the plug on all of the energy that we use today. So that's why talking solutions is so important. People don't realize that there's more jobs in the solar energy industry today than in the coal industry across the whole U.S. Here in Texas, we have over 30,000 jobs in wind and solar alone. Around the world, we are already over 20% of our electricity is being generated by renewable sources. And 70% of all new electricity is renewable as well. And this is growing local jobs, investing in local economies. And it's actually creating economic booms, especially in rural areas that don't have a lot of other alternatives. So talking solutions is really important, and it can get past some of these objections, which, again, are mostly to do with solutions, with kind of an icing or a smokescreen of theological sounding or scientific sounding arguments on top.
Thanks for that call, Nate. And I'm sorry we don't have time to take the second part of your question, because, Catherine, I want to make sure that we get some very concrete suggestions from you. So we're getting together with family or friends. We may or may not know what their positions are on climate change. We may or may not know actually what their specific faith beliefs are. How do you address this? I mean, I'm guessing you feel so strongly about this issue that you don't wait for it to just kind of naturally come up.
Well, I think having it naturally come up is a good thing. But what I do is look for points in our conversation or points of connection where it actually is natural to bring climate change into the discussion. So if we're talking about the economy, it's natural to bring in how, you know, the job benefits of renewable energy, or the fact that China is beating the pants off the U.S. when it comes to the amount of clean energy that they've got installed. When we're talking about our kids, it's natural to bring in the issues of, you know, air quality and our kids' health. And what about all those kids who are striking for climate, you know, taking Fridays off school? What do you think about that? So there's many ways that we can actually bring it into the conversation. But the best place to start is with something that we genuinely care about, that really matters to us, that also matters to the person or people we're talking to. So then we have this point of connection to walk together into the discussion on climate change, rather than starting the discussion from something that we most disagree on, or just dropping climate change kind of like a dead fish into the middle of the conversation, which really kind of ensures that it never goes anywhere.
Well, Catherine, thank you so much for joining us. So much more to talk about, but we're just out of time.
Thank you.
That was Catherine Hayhoe, climate scientist and director of Texas Tech University's Climate Science Center. She was with us today after her visit to two UW campuses in Madison and Eau Claire this week to talk about faith and climate change. Coming up Monday on Central Time, similar to what we just spoke about, for many of the people leaving Central American countries like Guatemala to migrate north, climate change is tied to their decision in one way or another. We talk with a reporter about how changing climate conditions are driving immigration into the United States. And we'll also take a look at some recent exciting science news with Bill Andrews. He's from Discover Magazine. All that and much more coming up Monday here on Central Time.